This is CBSI on the World with Gordon Chang at Gordon G. Chang. And we're very pleased to be joined by Professor James Holmes. Jim Holmes is the Wiley Chair of Maritime Strategy at the Naval War College. He blogs at the Naval Diplomat. Jim, a question about the submarine fleet. Over the years in our conversations and reading, my understanding is our submarine fleet is the dominant force that China has not matched with its rapid build-out of the PLA Navy, and that anti-submarine warfare is a weakness of the PLA Navy, and that our submarine fleet is not only dominant, but looks to improve itself in the future with new class of attack submarine and a new class of nuclear weapon capable, the Boomers. Is all that still accurate, Jim, that the U.S. submariners are the advantage the U.S. has? Good evening to you.
Hi, John. Hey, Gordon. I think it is still true that this is the core of U.S. maritime power in the Western Pacific. I think that I think China has made impressive strides across the board, including in undersea warfare. However, when they started off building a great PLA Navy in the mid 1990s, they centered it on conventional submarines, diesel electric submarines, and actually have done pretty well there. However, they have lagged in naval nuclear propulsion, which is something they've only started to get right. It's interesting. There was sort of a cultural hangover from the Cultural Revolution of the 60s and 70s, in which it was really dangerous to be a technical expert on something like nuclear energy, and that really set China and the Chinese military back. And I think they're still struggling with that.
A note here: the Wall Street Journal publishes an article: the U.S. Navy's submarine fleet, America's essential warfighting instrument in the Indo-Pacific, is about 3/5 of the size it should be, chiefly because of maintenance and production delays. Is this special to the submarine fleet? Because I've been led to understand we do not have enough shipyards for the demands of the fleet now, especially that's true overseas. Or is that true for surface ships as well, James?
Well, it's true. That's pretty much true across the board. The Navy leadership recently has been pretty forthright about saying that it's going to be really tough for us to repair battle damage because we're having a hard time keeping up with maintenance in general. So it is a problem in the submarine. Well, I guess you would say it's a bigger problem in the submarine community just because there's so much specialized skills and materials that go into nuclear powered warships. For example, welding is something that is much more demanding than it is in a surface vessel that's not operating a nuclear power plant. And obviously handling uranium and so forth, this is a big deal. So big problem across the board. If you can't keep up with maintenance in peacetime, how are you going to keep up in wartime when ships are coming back damaged?
Of course, our concern is about Taiwan. That's driving these concerns because of threats. Gordon, you have a question for Jim.
Jim, in wartime, navies, militaries in general, tend to speed up processes. They tend to cut corners. They tend to get things done. With regard to submarine maintenance, would the situation improve in wartime if we were maybe less bureaucratic, maybe threw more people at it? Is that a possibility, or is that just not possible in today's modern warfare?
Well, I mean, I think it probably goes back to the divide between nuclear propulsion and conventional weapons and ships. In the plant, a submarine plant, I mean, that you can sort of cordon that off, and that's probably not going to be something that you could speed up. When you're outside the power plant, however, that's a conventional warship, and I think there are ways that you could do things to accelerate maintenance processes. So I guess the answer is sort of yes and no. I mean, we had a couple of serious accidents in the submarine fleet back in the 1960s. The sinking is of the Thresher and the Scorpions. Ever since then, the submarine fleet has been absolutely obsessed with safety in the plant. And I think that's a cultural barrier that you probably would not overcome even in wartime.
Jim, the president most recently in 60 Minutes has restated what he's told Xi Jinping in the past several times now, 1, 2, 3, 4 times, that the U.S. will contribute military equipment and personnel to defend Taiwan. That would depend, I imagine, on being able to deliver it, and that would be the U.S. Navy. Is the U.S. Navy in a position right now to follow through on the president's intention? Does it have the ships and the personnel in the Western Pacific to fight?
Well, I guess I would look at it in sort of in two ways. I think the Navy and I think Congress has been pretty upfront about not having the size fleet we need. There's a of course ever since President Trump's days, we've been talking about 355 ships. That's written into U.S. law. And we have made very little progress towards that. This year, CNO Gilday, Admiral Gilday, our top uniformed naval officer, has basically come out in his latest instruction to the fleet and said, "Hey, we need 500 ships as opposed to about 300 today. 150 of those being unmanned, uncrewed vessels of various types and uncrewed aircraft." So I think that's a pretty strong statement that we're at about 60% of. So you said 60% a few minutes ago. That I would say sounds like we're about 60% of what we need, which I guess it raises the question of whether we are prepared to really unbalance the fleet towards the Western Pacific, as far as withdrawing assets from the Atlantic and the Middle East and so forth. We haven't really, and especially now with Ukraine going on, we really haven't made that move.
Gordon, you have a question for Jim.
Jim, you were talking about fleet size. The Navy is on a path to decommission a number of platforms, including Ticonderoga-class cruisers. That would seem to be, when you say you have to increase the fleet, but at the same time, you're making the fleet smaller. That would, at least on the surface, seem to be contradictory.
Well, it did, and that's a point that's been brought up quite a bit by commentators across the spectrum, including most notably Representative Luria out of Hampton Roads in Virginia, who is always she's a former naval officer herself and is very worried about taking all that missile capacity out of the fleet at a time we think we're in a danger zone right now with China because for various reasons. So talking about the Davidson window, Admiral Davidson's prediction that China might go to war over Taiwan by 2027, which is only 5 years from now. I think it's a real problem. Now that the Navy wants the resources. It's basically taking the tack of saying to Congress, here's what you get for the money that you are providing. If you don't provide enough money for additional hulls, we will plow that money into basically stocking up our munitions stockpile so that we have a lot of weapons to go in the tubes that we have to fire them out of. So I don't think that's a satisfactory response, but I think that's sort of where we are. There's actually an interesting historical point. I've taken to calling attention to the year 1940 when the fall of France to Germany really shocked Congress into basically passing a couple of bills to double the size of the Navy that summer. Will Ukraine have that sort of political impact in Congress? I don't see it yet, but I guess we'll see as Congress starts debating the next defense authorization bill whether Ukraine has had that sort of electrifying impact.
The last minute, Jim, do you hear from naval officers who teach your classroom or the comments by the professors? That not only do we need to attend to the fleet, but also do we have adequate shipyards to maintain the fleet we have right now?
Well, I think that's the real point. The shipyards are working as hard as they can, but they just don't have enough capacity as far as dry docks and skilled laborers and so forth to do it right now. We got in a really bad habit after the Cold War of thinking that peace was forever and that we didn't need to have excess capacity. We got into a mindset in which we were seeking maximum of efficiency, which means you don't keep extra capacity around in peacetime. That's fine, except for that when you get into wartime, you need excess capacity simply because you need to build stuff and you need to repair stuff in bulk fast.
I remind myself that the last time the U.S. moved its naval assets from the Atlantic Command to the Pacific Command was right before Pearl Harbor. James Holmes is a professor, the Wiley Chair of Maritime Strategy at the Naval War College, blogs at The Naval Diplomat. Gordon Chang at Gordon G. Chang. I'm John Batchelor.
You're listening to CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.